As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Let's get into the earnings right now with Peter Oppenheimer, Chief Global Equity Strategist at Goldman Sachs. Peter, everybody's talking about the step down for the Federal Reserve, maybe a shift from 75 to 50 to 25. Can we talk about the step down that you're expecting in earnings, in EPS, going back from 21 to 22 to 23?
Yeah, absolutely, John. I think this is really going to be a crucial factor that investors are going to have to take into account. We've seen some of the optimism building up again about the prospect for the rate rises to start to moderate. But on the other side of that, we're seeing a deterioration in earnings. This has been not a disastrous earnings season, but certainly not nearly as strong as we've seen previously. And the key thing that's happening, and we've been arguing this for some time, is that margins are starting to come under pressure as a result of these higher input costs. And that means that the forward-looking earnings are also deteriorating. Revisions are starting to come down. And I think it's too premature for markets to be really pricing peak interest rates without taking into account the lower earnings and growth that's coming on the other side of that.
Peter, the seismic change for next year is we have a risk-free rate. We have gravity, as Taleb says it. Do you assume more transactions and truly more combinations as stocks, as corporations confront a reality from decades ago?
Yeah, absolutely. This is an overwhelming shift that's happened. I mean, we have to take into account that it was only at the beginning of last year that the markets were only pricing one or two rate rises this year in the US, nothing in Europe until next year. And we've seen now a whole range of significant rate increases with more to come. And, you know, just over a year ago, a quarter of all government debt around the world had a negative yield. People were paying for the privilege of lending to governments. Now you're getting around 4% for US 10-year treasuries. This is a big shift, and it requires valuations of financial assets to moderate. We've seen some of that, but probably not enough given the scale of that shift in the cost of capital. And that's why we think there's more downside in the near term on valuations and market pricing.
We're talking in general, but I was looking at a FANG Plus index that is down 49% from its recent peak. I mean, some of the declines in specific sectors have been extraordinary. Peter, have we seen the bulk of the pain in some of the high flyers and some of the tech names, or is it still broad-based? Is it really a more general kind of re-rating, repricing that still needs to take place?
Well, I think that what you've really seen is the rise in interest rates hitting the longest duration assets most aggressively to begin with, things like unprofitable tech, which had its rout earlier in the year. Profitable tech companies, cash generative tech and long duration companies had held up reasonably well, but they're now coming under pressure because they are impacted by the gravity of rising rates and indeed some slowdown in their earnings, you know, as well. So I think it's really about the broad index adjusting valuations to levels which are consistent to a new normal in terms of interest rates. Having said all that, what we have seen is a bit of a reversal of that 10 or 12 year trend that preceded this year, where growth was hugely outperforming value, supported by record low rates and phenomenally strong earnings in the growth sectors. this year has been a year predominantly of value outperformance. And I think that probably has some further to go. So the aggregate valuations probably still need to adjust downwards, but we are seeing a shift in the mix. And it's pretty extraordinary that despite the hit that we've seen to some of the really big tech stocks through this earnings season, the broader Dow, for example, has continued to do very well. And I think that's a reflection of this shift in leadership within the markets.
I'm so happy that, Peter, that Tom wasn't listening at the end there at all. Peter Oppenheimer of Goldman Sachs.
Right now, for Global Wall Street, lean forward because Edward Morse joins us. He's Global Head of Commodities Research at Citigroup. Priya Misra of TD Securities, I think of with the real yield. John, there have been other calls that we've seen through the year. Mike Wilson in equities. And Ed Morse nailed oil. There's no question about it. When it was over $100 a barrel, he said, no, maybe not. And here we are under $100 a barrel. Ed Morse, to cut to the chase, if China reopens, many say that will give a demand that will get oil back above $100 a barrel, even to 110, 120. Do you agree?
Actually, we don't agree. It depends on a lot of other things. The only way to get oil back to 110 or 120 is to have a bunch of supply disruptions from places like Libya, Nigeria, and maybe even Iran and Iraq. It's a supply side phenomenon to get above. And yes, we have OPEC Plus thinking that they need to put a floor under prices and they can work at that a little bit. But no, China demand coming back will, of course, have an impact on the market. But we're in a world where demand is sloshing downward around the world, whether you look at the U.S. or Europe. And China, yeah, it's the third biggest economy in the world, had low demand. But look at where they've been in the last 2 months. Since the middle of the summer, they first went up 1 million barrels a day on imports. Now they're up 2 million barrels a day on imports. And we're having oil since the last OPEC Plus meeting, in a sideways little dance. It's not going anywhere. So I think there's ample supply in the market for us to not have a big impact from China coming back.
So, Ed, why are we draining the SPR? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I'm on the side of those who think these are unusual times. We're actually in what Fiona Hill, as you know, calls World War III. And the instruments are basically economic instruments. Some of them are used foolishly, like the price cap that you were just discussing. Some of them, I think, are a bit wise. And let's look at the SPR. So if we look at the world to date, we've had an inventory build year to date. That inventory build accelerated. And now the inventory build, as we measure it, is bigger than the SPR release. So the SPR release was there to tide over times when we had a first warfare reaction to Russia and Ukraine with oil embargoes imposed on Russian oil. And there was a bidding up of the price of Brent and WTI as a result. We have another potential round of that coming up by December 5th, which is associated with the potential oil cap or the price cap. But we're going to have this bidding up already, and we're already seeing the bidding up. And the SPR is playing an important role in it. So we have so far in the world year to date, as of the middle of last week, to the degree we can measure it, an inventory build of 112 million barrels. The SPR is a big chunk of that.
Well,
actually, the build has been 273 million barrels year to date.
Yeah.
The SPR is 230 million of that. But if we look at the last 2 months, forgetting about the SPR, on a combined, from September to the middle of October, oil on land has risen by 30 million barrels. But more tellingly, oil in the water has risen by 82 million barrels. It's oil in transit. And a lot of that is coming actually from the U.S. The last week's data printed a U.S. export number of an astonishing 11.2 million barrels a day, the highest on record. And we've been, playing with 10 million barrels a day for the last 3 months. So the U.S. has really been supplying the world and taking the edge off of what would have been, a difficult distortion with the
With the conflict that we saw over with respect to Russia invading Ukraine. Given that backdrop, do you think, Ed, that we're ever going to get back down to that $72 a barrel kind of level that the U.S. administration has said they would really start buying barrels to refill the SPR. Are we going to get there in the next year, for example?
I think we could get there. It depends on the nature of the recession and how reactive people are. We have to remember that this is a world with a lot less open interest in futures and options than we had before. So volatility levels are, you know, very high, and we have $10 or $15 moves that have become the normal in this high volatility world. So I would not exclude $70. I would also note that the administration has not nailed a particular number. They're giving a range. That range is in the kind of 60 to 80. You get to 70 by looking at a 60 to 80 range. And the intriguing thing of this is that we have a U.S. government range that, you know, averages, as you say, $70 for buying SPR to put a floor under prices. And we have OPEC, where it's in the $85-$95 range. It's intriguing that China also has a range with a bottom and a top, and they activate policies. If oil gets below or above that range, they buy for strategic stocks, but they freeze prices at home, or they sell strategic stocks by freezing prices at home at the upper level. So, you know, we have sensitivity now to not going back to negative pricing, not going back to, you know, $20 pricing because of what it does to the production side. It's kind of a new world when you have the largest economies, along with OPEC Plus on the producer side, and by the way, the largest oil producing country, namely the US, thinking about what the floor ought to be.
All getting in on a game. Ed Moss of Citi, one of the very best. Ed, thank you, sir, as always.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Our good news is Michael Gapin's with us, the chief U.S. economist at Bank of America. Thrilled he could be with us. He's from the University of James Bullard, also known as Indiana University, and of course with work at the International Monetary Fund as well. Thank you so much, Dr. Gapin, for joining us today. I want to cut right to the chase. You, and I give Chris Lowe at FTN a credit for this as well. There's a massive illusion to the American economy Jerome Powell faces today, and that is within the core equation, net exports are holding us up. How poor are domestic final sales?
So final sales to domestic purchasers, which would be GDP less trade and inventories, grew at 0.4 in the third quarter, and it was 0.2, I believe, in the second quarter.
Is that a recession indicator?
No, it would essentially be the Fed soft landing, where growth is positive, but not, you know, still below trend. So the interest rate sensitive sectors of the economy, housing, structures, were really what weighed on activity in the third quarter. I think the inventory rebuilding cycle is also largely behind us. So yes, we got the boost from trade in the quarter, but it accounted for all of the growth in the quarter. Yeah. Underneath that, the economy is cooling down.
We've been talking about the lag time, right? The lag, the variable effects, the lag time that the Fed is watching right now. How long would you estimate it takes before the full effect, the dampening effect of the rate hikes that have been executed so far take effect?
The cumulative effect probably as long as 12 to 18 months. You see the initial signs of it maybe 6 to 9 months out, like we are now. The interest rate sensitive sectors tend to respond first. If financial conditions tightened in March and April, you'd expect by the third quarter of the year it's going to show up, and it is. The cumulative effect, it's got to matriculate all the way through the rest of the economy, 12 to 18 months.
How high does unemployment need to go to get inflation down? This is the number one question that these senators have right now. What kind of damage is this Fed going to do to achieve its ultimate objective of getting back to 2%.
So our forecast is that it'll be a little higher than the Fed thinks. We're up to about 5.5% is where we think the unemployment rate may go. The Fed, as you know, is looking at about a percentage point rise to the mid fours. I'd say consensus is probably around 5. So somewhere between the 4.5 to 5.5 range seems to be what we're all thinking. The Fed, your point's exactly spot on. The Fed's saying we need to remove imbalances in the labor market to bring inflation down. That's a bit of a euphemism for we think the unemployment rate has to rise to better balance supply and demand. That is the number one question right now. We say a little more than others.
Your research was cited by Senator Warren. I'm sure you're aware of that. She put it in her letter to Chairman Powell. Bank of America expects that unemployment will peak at 5.6%, implying a nearly 2 percentage point jump in the unemployment rate over the next year and the loss of more than 3 million jobs. The question they're asking Chairman Powell, is this the price we need to pay? Is it worth paying this price to get inflation down? Now, I don't expect you to do Chairman Powell's work for him, but there is this line.
Oh, you can if you want.
This line that he used in Jackson Hole, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it. He said a failure to restore price stability would mean far greater pain. Can you elaborate on that a little bit for us, Mike, how people understand what would happen if they didn't tackle this?
So the Fed's belief, I'm wired the same way, is to think that the economy performs best over the very long term when we're not spending an hour talking about where is inflation and where is it going. You want to remove that variable off the table. So low and stable inflation gets you the best macro outcomes over the long term. I think there's we make a mistake right now when we think, oh, the Fed's going to over-tighten and make a policy error. I think the Fed is saying, no. The policy error is not getting inflation down to 2%. Now, we don't know if we need a recession to get us there. But if we do, if that is ultimately what's needed, the Fed would say we should pay that price now because, to your point, waiting and paying it later, history says, well, we're going to have to pay a lot more. So we don't like to be in the position that we're in, but we need to remove imbalances in the labor market, and we think we need to get to that sooner than later. So the true policy mistake is not getting inflation down to 2. It's not, the mistake is not creating some pain in the labor market to get there, if that makes sense.
Do you know who's in their office right now, Tom? Chairman Powell making notes for the news conference where you get asked the question.
What's great, I read the Senator Warren letter carefully. Senator Warren did not cite Mark Cabana. I don't know what that is about. He's citing Gapin, but not Cabana.
Well, Cabana does the stuff on the balance sheet. The balance sheet unwind. And, Mike Gapin there, Bank of America.
David Rubenstein will speak with the Surgeon General of the United States. That is Vivek Murthy, and he joins David here for a peer-to-peer conversation. Look for that 9 p.m. Tonight. Mr. Rubenstein joins us right now on this most unique physician. David, what I love about Dr. Murthy is 20 years ago at Yale, he basically invented something called healer's art. He seems to have been a generation ahead on the mental health challenges that we have all lived in a pandemic. What did you learn about him, about the persistency of the challenges we face?
Well, he's very concerned about the mental health problems that our country has coming out of COVID, and obviously for school children as well. And he's also concerned about the isolation many young men have and the mental health problems associated with it. And we've seen some of that recently, obviously. So he's worked hard on that. The Surgeon General of the United States is a position that is not known to a lot of people about what it actually is. It's a position where he's designed to talk about healthcare issues, advise the president, and oversee 6,000 healthcare professionals around the country. He's been the Surgeon General under President Obama, and then, to his surprise, was reappointed under President Biden. He's the first person to do it twice under two different presidents. He's a very talented person, the son of immigrants from India, grew up in Florida, valedictorian of his class, went to Harvard, Yale Medical School, very, very talented person.
What does he say about COVID? He mentioned there in the comments, it's still germane, but have we deluded ourselves that COVID is over under 400 deaths per day?
Yes, you've got 300 to 400 deaths per day, and these people who are dying, in his view, because they're unvaccinated or they haven't kept up to date with their vaccinations. So I just came through COVID myself, and the first time I had it, and I'm up to date on my vaccines, but I probably could have gotten a booster more readily than I probably did the most recent one. but maybe that's why I got it. But his point is that people are not vaccinated at all. They are really in danger of being one of the 300 to 400 a week who are dying. And so we're not completely out of the woods here, in large part because about a third of our country doesn't want to be vaccinated.
Well, David, I'm glad that you're feeling better. And a lot of people have been going through it right now. Just pairing the two ideas that we just have been through a pandemic that caused real fissures in the social fabric that have exacerbated some of these mental health issues. Did Dr. Murthy talk about that, about how the pandemic and some of the responses really did exacerbate the mental health problems in the nation?
Yes. What happens is when you stay at home, you think, okay, I'm going to be safe, but actually you are deteriorating your ability to relate to other people. And ultimately, for many people who become so isolated, they have mental health challenges. His biggest concern is the mental health isolation right now in the country. There are a lot of healthcare problems, obviously, opioid addiction, cancer, a whole bunch of other problems. But right now, his particular focus is healthcare, mental health. And that's something he's focused on his whole career.
Yeah, with respect to loneliness, really, and what that does to people as well. I'm wondering what this says with respect to any kind of response from a government like the United States to additional pandemics or other health problems, if there is this add-on of the mental health component afterwards, which could be just as pernicious, if not more so, certainly in certain communities and among certain kids who are actually having to re-socialize going back to school.
Yes, you don't really know what the impact is going to be until much later. In other words, if you get COVID, you can see the impact right away. But if you're isolated and you have a mental health problem, you might not pick that up for 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, and you might not get the kind of treatment you needed. And one of the things he points out is that mental health problems don't get reimbursed by insurers or the federal government quite the way that physical health problems do. And so there's certain stigma associated with mental health. There always has been, but the stigma hasn't gone away. And the insurers still don't reimburse you for mental health treatment that you might need.
David, is the Surgeon General job, if you will, is it political? Do they just try to find somebody with major chops in medicine? Or is it a political football from Republican to Democrat to Republican?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a political football, but I would say that you need to be a healthcare professional. But clearly, you are appointed by a president and you're confirmed by the Senate. And the first time around, when he was appointed by President Obama, he had a difficult time being confirmed because he had said that there was a problem with guns in our country, and that was seen as a healthcare problem. And many people didn't want to confirm him for that. He did get confirmed. This time, it wasn't so complicated. I would say nothing in Washington is apolitical. And I would say there's still some political nature to it.
David Rubenstein.
Unfortunately.
Well, thank you so much, David. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Carlyle Group, the co-chairman, and of course the host of the David Rubenstein Show. Peer-to-peer conversation here on medicine and something gripping all of us, regardless of our politics, the mental health of the nation. The Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, with David Rubenstein. Look for that. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.